I'm Christopher Leiden for Open Source, with a prince among China watchers today, Ian Johnson, won a Pulitzer Prize covering China for the Wall Street Journal, mostly economics. And then he discovered what felt like a much bigger story about a full-blown spiritual crisis inside a frenzied money culture. In Chinese villages and booming big cities alike, what he came to see unmistakably over 6 years on the road was a restoration being allowed to take place across the peculiar mix of Chinese religions, Buddhist meditation and Taoist exercises and Confucian moral discipline. No high walls between them and Christian worship either. Touching a lot of the same people, but centered not so much on the God questions as how to organize Chinese life again around communities of belief and ritual and practice. What Confucianist advice do you want before you invest, for example? And do we head for a cave together for peace and quiet? What Ian Johnson sees is a vast identity search in a people who've been tossed and tussled by outsiders and now by a century of their own modern revolutions, people still fiercely hungry in a historic boom time. I'd heard of Ian Johnson, sort of legend among reporters who cover China, and then I read his book. It's called The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. Ian Johnson visited me in Boston around the time the Chinese President Xi Jinping was visiting President Trump at Mar-a-Lago.
We tend to think of Xi Jinping more as, you know, cracking down on corruption and overseas adventures like in the South China Sea and challenging Japan on the islands. But I think domestically, his biggest thing is spiritual revival. And he made that very clear when he took power in 2012.
Made it clear how?
He went to the History Museum on Tiananmen Square and declared that his prime task would be the spiritual revival of the Chinese nation. There's still a big malaise in China, feeling that there's no common values, that there's nothing that people share. After the traditional society collapsed in the 20th century and communism collapsed, what unites society? What are the shared values? What makes China, China, rather than just another outpost of the neoliberal economic system? You know, Chinese people have given up their traditional clothes. A lot of stuff has been given up. Politically, culturally.
Villages, families.
Yeah, all that. Extended families through the single child policy and so on and so forth. So there's a big worry in society. And so she has cleverly tapped into that. He didn't exactly start, it didn't all start with Xi Jinping, but he's ramped it up afterwards. You can see the way the party cloaks its message in this pseudo-traditional imagery.
A lot of people say European society, American society, shows symptoms of a deep spiritual loss, hunger. How do you know it when you see it in China? What does it look like? How does it feel?
Some of it you see in social media and online discussions where Chinese people express disgust, disappointment with their own society, the unwillingness of people to help each other on the street, the crises that people have in food, for example, and trusting the kind of food that they eat, the endless constant scandals over tainted milk, tainted infant formula, unsafe cooking oil. People feel that you can't really trust anything anymore in society. They feel that the only way that you can get ahead is by knowing people. We have this, of course, in our own societies. It's not what you know, it's who you know, the old boys network, all of that. But in China, it defines almost all kinds of interactions. Even public schools require under-the-table bribes, and you feel that the game is really rigged against you. So a lot of people wonder, what does our society stand for? Who are we? What is China?
Do they remember another time, Ian?
I remember in the 1980s when I went there to start. This was just after the Cultural Revolution. People were hoping that the 30 years, roughly, of Maoism was an aberration and that the communists would be able to start or inculcate a kinder, gentler China, that there would be some reckoning with the past and that there would be some kind of opening and political reform. There was something like that that started, but it was cut off by conservatives, and this all culminated in 1989 with the Tiananmen Square massacre. And that pretty much ended any chance of social reform, political reform. Instead, what happened was a complete emphasis on economic growth as a way to placate the population, that we can't give you an open society, a more caring, kinder society. You can't create your own society or change it or influence it, but we'll give you economic growth. We'll give you prosperity.
Speak of the community. How much of it is just pining for the village or the image of their grandparents, and how much of it is some substantive, what we would call religion, some sense of the eternal?
Well, I think a pining for the past is really important. And you mentioned the village, and there you have to look at this rampant, almost out of control, forced urbanization that's been going on in China, where the government has pushed people into cities, thinking that modern countries are urban countries, and therefore we have to speed up the process by forcing people to give up their farms and move into housing towers. And this has created a great amount of anomie or unhappiness. And with this urbanization also has come a destruction of the old communal religious life. So the two are related, because villages were centered around temples. And when you destroy the villages, you destroy the temples, you don't have this communal space anymore. So part of it is a search for the eternal, for purely religious questions, but part of it is the social infrastructure that goes with it. Being with people all the time in the temple, maybe not thinking so closely about the actual beliefs, but having that kind of camaraderie that goes sometimes with spiritual life that people probably know from any religion. Just going to the coffee after the church is almost more important than the church itself, right?
Yeah, Emerson said the stillness in the church before the service is the most important part of the whole Sunday. Ian Johnson, let me just say, I learned a lot from your book about so-called Chinese religion. We think of it kind of, are you a Buddhist? Are you a Taoist? Are you a Confucianist? And of course you say, no, Chinese religion is mixes and matches. And we've known that Chinese sort of cover their bets too. I mean, they love to go from one to the other, and maybe a Christian church for good luck. It is communal, but it's also ritual. It is also habit, parents and children. And so that it's maybe more mysterious, but less really puzzling than we think of when we think of sorting out the elements of Chinese religion.
Yeah, theology does not play a huge role
exactly.
In Chinese religion.
How many angels on the head of a pin is not a Chinese question.
Yeah, using the sort of tools of Greek logic to prove or disprove a proposition is not something you find too much in Chinese religion. Most people are happy to participate because they feel it gives structure to their lives. And ritual, although we often think of ritual being empty or unimportant, it's really the profound question of how you act in a certain situation. Like, what's the proper way to mourn a dead person? What's the proper way to behave in relation to other people in society? And those are pretty important questions. Those are actually quite profound. I think what also I found is that there's a great exuberance in the religious life of China. Like, if you think of this pilgrimage outside of Beijing to Miaofengshan, there's a whole lot of people, you know, drinking and smoking cigarettes and cursing and yelling at each other. And
Canterbury Tales.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not all sort of sitting quietly, meditating and saying om or something like that.
Speak of your own search for a kind of intangible phenomenon and some of the people you find along the way, not just in Beijing, but who are bringing back a religious framework as the scheme of organizing a society. And then we've got to figure out where in the world it goes in the regime of Xi Jinping and others.
Well, a couple of examples. One were these caves south of Shanghai. These were middle-class people, doctors, lawyers, architects, engineers, and they had been drawn to this old Taoist form of internal cultivation, something a bit like yoga, physical practice, but it involved a little bit more breathing and quiet sitting than yoga. And they went to these caves and meditated there for these retreats that lasted about 10 days because they wanted something else in their life. They wanted the physical practice, which is quite important in Chinese religion, and they wanted the moral guidance, the old ideas of Taoism, traditional China, back present in their life in some way. So they took vacation and they went down there and did this. And then when they went back home, they practiced on their own at home. So this is something you don't see physically. It's not like you can see a new temple being built, but these are people who are doing stuff at home. And I think that's similar to our societies as well, where a lot of spiritual practice becomes something personal that you do. You don't necessarily show it outwardly.
Do you engage with those people?
Yeah, a lot. I joined this spiritual or this physical practice called internal alchemy I did a lot of that over the years. They had a great image. The guy said, just let all your memories and the stuff that's filled your head, it's like a movie projector, and it's hurtling forward. And eventually, if you just sit quietly long enough, the reel will come to an end, and you'll just have a bit of peace and quiet in your mind.
Oh, my word.
And I think that that's not a bad thing to try for anybody. And I don't think it requires a lot of training or practice, but it's a good idea, I think.
That sounds specifically Taoist. Speak of some of the other varieties.
Well, another thing, very radically different form, was in the southwestern city of Chengdu, where I spent quite a lot of time with a Protestant church. These could be called an underground church or a house church, but it's really big. It has about 300 members. They bought a floor of an office building, and they created this entire religious infrastructure, including a seminary, kindergarten, elementary school, and set up church branches around Chengdu. Really impressive, and not registered with the government at all. Mm-hmm. Strictly speaking, illegal. But it's extremely vibrant and led by one of the most charismatic and convincing pastors I've ever encountered. And I say this having grown up in a Protestant household with a fairly religious background, an incredible sermonizer, fantastic sermons that lasted 45 minutes and had you sort of riveted there.
What's the theme?
Well, he is a former human rights lawyer who converted to Christianity in 2005, and he's often challenging the way society is organized. He's trying to tell people that they have power over their lives. They create value. It's not the Communist Party. It's not the materialistic world around them. It's by being good people and living a good life according to the Bible that they create a real peace and a real holistic society around them. And I think that was actually a really popular message. He also had a practice of radical transparency. If you wanted to join his group, you had to give your ID card, let them photocopy it. And if you attended church on Sunday, on Monday, a police officer would come by and they would give the police officer the names of everybody who attended. And any donations had to be signed so they could say, okay, we got $5 from Mr. Wong, and here's his name and address.
To what end all the disclosure?
They don't want foreign ties. They don't want foreign money. They don't want to be accused of being a tool or a puppet of foreign forces or missionaries. They want to say, no, this is local Chinese people doing this. And that way, I think they protect themselves to a degree.
It's a kind of commentary on the government, but not a revolutionary threat or anything. But how did the government respond?
Well, so far, the church is still open. The pastor has not been detained, although I kept thinking throughout the year or so where I was intensively following them, I kept thinking, I don't know how much longer this can go on. But I think the government feels that as long as you're not explicitly agitating against the government, they can allow this to go on, especially in a city outside of Beijing. I think some of our problems in perceiving China is that we're too Beijing-centric. And Beijing is the most political city. It's where the government's power is the strongest. And we tend to overemphasize the government's strength when we see everything in Beijing. And it's really important to get outside of Beijing. Go to the countryside, go to the second-tier cities. It's just like if you were in the United States and you wanted to perceive everything and you were only living in, say, the Upper West Side of New York City or something like that. People would think you're crazy if you'd never traveled to Kansas or California.
Ian, your friend and ours, Michael Pewitt at Harvard, who's deeply drawn into Confucian thinking, he told us many months ago that Confucianism cannot survive neoliberalism in China, a kind of money worship, and maybe it works the other way too. But speak of that, what are the Confucian traces in this revival?
Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time with a Confucian master who lived in the Shanghai area. He had many followers, business people, children of party officials who found his message revolutionary. For example, one businessman was there and he asked him, he said, I want to invest in a cure for Alzheimer's. What do you think? And so this Confucian master is at the time, I think he was 94 years old. And he said, there's no cure for Alzheimer's. People get old, they die. You should think of something else. And the businessman then said, well, I got this other thing I want to invest in, which is green energy, solar power. And he said, that's a good idea. That's future-oriented. Invest in that. And it was a funny idea because, you know, he wasn't giving him some advice based on return on investment, but more of a moral way of looking at it. Like, don't follow the charlatanistic thing that's going to cure Alzheimer's. Try to follow something that will have a positive impact on society. And for some people, this is really revelatory to have things explained like that.
What's the reemergence you see of that kind of thinking or that kind of practice?
For a couple of millennia, Chinese society has been held together by the idea that laws alone are not enough to hold a society together. There's a school of thought in traditional China, the legalists, who said all you need are harsh punishments and laws, and that will work. And that's essentially what the government offers today. You've got laws, and you've got to follow them, or you get in trouble. Confucianism has always said you need shared moral values. You need shared ideas to hold a society together. We tend to sometimes think of Confucianism almost in a cartoonish way of being purely hierarchical and top-down. It forces people to follow the leader. But it works both ways. And Confucianism has this idea that you've got to improve your heart, you've got to cultivate your heart and your family. But it goes out. You also then cultivate your society. Because Confucian had this idea that there has to be justice in society. And this is a really important idea that in the long, long run can challenge the party. Not tomorrow, it's not going to create some sort of a revolution tomorrow, but it creates these higher ideas of uprightness, justice, that is way beyond anything that a party can offer.
There's a wonderful moment in your book, a surprise, when Xi Jinping, this is years ago, and he's working his way up in a provincial level, but he is embracing something of the Buddhist revival in China, as I read it.
Yeah, the anecdote you're talking about comes from the 1980s, the early 1980s, when he was assigned to a poor rural town to be the deputy party secretary there, and eventually the party secretary. He formed an alliance with a Buddhist monk who was very well known, and he helped them rebuild a very famous temple in China. And later he sent, when he moved on to other positions, he sent officials by to look at this and say, this is the kind of thing we should be doing. And he encouraged Buddhists to spread the Buddhist word around China. I think he did this for a couple of reasons. One is he sees traditional religions as creating these kind of shared values. And he views Buddhism, Taoism, and maybe what we could loosely call folk religion, Confucianism, etc., as less threatening than Christianity or Islam, that these are religions that are more compatible with traditional Chinese political thought and some sort of Communist Party rule than, say, Christianity, which I think people like him see as a foreign religion with foreign ties.
What is the Buddhist word? I mean, pass it along. What is the substance of it?
Well, I think what he would see Buddhism being as doing good works, being an honest person, not killing, these kind of basic moral precepts. I think he would probably not see Buddhism as having anything to do with the Dalai Lama.
I was just going to say, would it soften that bad connection nowadays?
Probably not. No, I think they have a very tight control over Tibetan Buddhism. And when the Dalai Lama one day passes away, they will find a reincarnated Dalai Lama inside China, regardless of what the exiled Tibetan community in India finds. They'll probably end up being two Dalai Lamas. And this will be a great tragedy when this happens. It'll be something similar to when there were two popes in the Catholic Church. You know, historically, we've seen that.
China has, for a century, has just been hooked, really drugged and addicted to the idea of revolution. One revolution or another, industrial revolution, thinking revolution, capitalist revolution. And it's sort of helter-skelter from one to the next. And that's where they lost all these spiritual family village values that you feel reemerging. Does that make sense? And is it at this point a hopeful vision for China in the world that it is deeply aware of something missing in the game for a century?
Yeah, I think they have had one revolution after another, and I think people are just exhausted from it. You know, under Mao, it was revolution. Under Deng, it was reform. But reform also involved wrenching changes to society, to economics. Tens of millions of people losing their jobs in these big Rust Belt areas. And that's why Xi Jinping is so popular, by embracing and supporting tradition and saying, we're going to try to create a society that's calmer. Even his predecessors started this with the terms like harmonious society. And Xi has just push that. So it's actually quite a revolutionary change, if you will, that China has turned its back on revolution, that it is now trying to create a more stable society that changes, but slowly and in more organic ways than by pushing change from above.
Can you imagine in this evolving 21st century that the Chinese spiritual search could lead the world in some fashion? I'm thinking Europe and Russia and even this country too, looking for kind of a new handle.
I think it puts China at the center of a global search for meaning and values in our societies. I think it could also help with China's elusive search for soft power, that it has interesting people, it has interesting religious traditions that are grappling with the same issues that we're grappling with. And I think it could also make China a little bit less of this fragile, hyper-mercantilist superpower that we've seen in the past. Part of this, though, involves the party letting go of some of the control that it has over religion in China. Right now, the party still tightly controls religious groups. It doesn't allow for a flourishing of religious life that we've seen in other countries, like in Taiwan, another Chinese society, which had an enormous religious renaissance in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It helped kind of pave the way, or was part of one of the big reasons for Taiwan democratizing. I think China right now is still too tightly controlled for it to really lead in the world. But it's not inconceivable if the party is weakened or if somehow it relaxes control over civil society, that you could see some of these religious leaders, like the guy I wrote about in the church, that he could become a global Christian leader. I mean, right now it's very hard for people like that to participate in the world because they have travel restrictions and they're not allowed to go to conferences and meet people. But if this were relaxed, I could see that happening. I don't think that Americans are going to all become Taoists or Confucianists or Zen Buddhists. There have been waves of that that have come into this country, and there are small groups of people who follow these practices. But I think more it helps put China at the center of this global conversation, and I think that could help China's role in the world and leadership position in the world. Much like, you know, the United States, in its spiritual traditions, the huge impact, for example, that Martin Luther King Jr. has had around the world.
Yes.
You go to countries like Germany, the huge goodwill that people view the United States, people who saw the civil rights movement happen, the immense goodwill they have toward the United States because of that. If China were unshackled a little bit by the party, you would probably see more things like that happening in China because of this ferment and desire for change. But again, I think it really depends on people being given a little bit of space to breathe.
Yeah, that's wonderful. The Martin Luther King Jr. voice is speaking of justice and courage and humanity under the skin. What might that China voice be saying?
I think it would have something that would resonate around the world would be justice. The idea that justice is something divine that is not given by a government, or is not something that a government gives a people as part of some sort of a gift, but is endowed somehow, not necessarily by God with a capital G, but as some sort of divine right that all people have, that you have the right to justice, uprighteousness, to respect toward people. This is something people kept talking over and over again, that the past 100 years, and especially the Cultural Revolution, destroyed respect among people, respect for each other, and that these traditions bring back the idea that you have to respect other people. You have to treat them as human beings. You can't just treat them as some kind of chattel or cheap labor or something like that. This is what people really yearn for around the world, I think, being treated seriously.
Ian Johnson's book is The Souls of China. He left me wondering if China could find itself in the forefront of a worldwide quest for the sort of understanding that gets people through the night. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks to Ian Johnson. And thank you for listening and for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.